Good evening, listeners and students of Hitler's Table Talk. That was just 1 minute taken from Richard Wagner's Siegfried Idyll that you just heard as we begin episode 8 this evening of the luncheon and supper time talks of Adolf Hitler that were taken down as notes between 1941 and 1944. Today's date is May 1st, 2014. I'm Carolyn Yeager.
And I'm Ray Goodwin.
And Ray, we both were just agreeing that this was a great section from the talks tonight, and I was going to look up some timeline information, but I didn't have time. But I will say before you start reading that you're going to say that there was a special guest at this first, see, it was midday, so it was a luncheon. He was a luncheon guest, probably in one of the headquarters, military headquarters that Hitler stayed in during these years. And he was Walter Funk, and I just want to, so I don't interrupt you, just want to tell people that Funk was the Minister of Economic Affairs from 1938 to 1945. That's a long time, actually, 7 years. And he was supposed to be quite brilliant, I read, from the time he was a child. But he wasn't the most ideal image of the Aryan man, but he wasn't always in the best of health, but he was quite brilliant. And he was tried with the major war criminals at Nuremberg and given a life sentence, but was released in 1957 because of ill health, and he died in 1960. Kind of a tragedy there. So
yes.
So okay, let's. Should we just get started, or you want to have any opening remarks? Go ahead.
Okay, just that, boy, you're absolutely correct. Particularly our first two entries for tonight's show concern themselves with economics. And, boy, that is one powerful attraction that National Socialism had working for it. And this first one starts 13th of October, 1941, midday. The countries we invite to participate in our economic system should have their share in the natural riches of the Russian regions, and they should find an outlet there for their industrial production. It will be sufficient to give them a glimpse of the possibilities, and they'll at once attach themselves to our system. Once this region is organized for us, all threat of unemployment in Europe will be eliminated. On the economic level, America could never be a partner for these countries. America can be paid only in gold. A commerce based on the exchange of products is not possible with America, for America suffers from a surplus of raw materials and a plethora of manufactured goods. This gold, which the Americans receive in exchange for the labor they supply, they hide it away in their strong rooms. And they imagine the world will yield to this policy born in the smoky brain of a Jewish thinker. The result is they're 13 million unemployed. If I were in America, I shouldn't be afraid. It would be enough to set afoot a gigantic autarkic economy. With their 9.5 million square kilometers of territory, in 5 years the problem would be solved. South America cannot offer the United States anything but what they already have in superfluity. The river of the future is the Danube. We'll connect it to the Dnieper and the Don by the Black Sea. The petroleum and grain will come flowing towards us. The canal from the Danube to the Main can never be built too big. Add to this the canal from the Danube to the Oder, and we'll have an economic circuit of unheard-of dimensions. Europe will gain in importance of herself. Europe, and no longer America, will be the country of boundless possibilities. If the Americans are intelligent, they'll realize how much it will be to their interest to take part in this work. There is no country that can be, to a larger extent, autarkic than Europe will be. Where is there a region capable of supplying iron of the quality of Ukrainian iron? Where can one find more nickel, more coal, more manganese, more molybdenum? The Ukraine is the source of manganese to which even America goes for its supplies. And on top of that, so many other possibilities. the vegetable oils, the hevea plantations to be organized. With 100,000 acres devoted to the growing of rubber, our needs are covered. The side that wins this war will have to concern itself only with economic juggleries. Here, we're still fighting for the possession of the soil. Despite all its efforts, the side that hasn't got the natural riches must end by going under. The world's wealth is boundless, and only a quarter of the surface of the globe is at present at humanity's disposal. It's for this quarter that everyone is fighting, and it's all in the natural order of things, for it makes for the survival of the fittest. When a man begets children without having previously enlarged the basis of his existence, it shows a lack of conscience on his part. But if he decides that he should therefore give up the idea of begetting children, he becomes doubly a sinner by making himself life's debtor. It's certain that worries never cease to trouble us. When I was a young man, I had worries to the extent of 10, 20, or 30 marks. The only period when I had no worries was the 6 years of my life as a soldier. Then one did not concern oneself with such matters. We were supplied with clothing, and although it was no great shakes, it was at least honorable. Lodging and board, or in default of lodging, leave to sleep somewhere or other. And after that, the worries came back, worries about the party, first to the extent of 10,000 marks, then of a few millions. After we took power, they were to the extent of thousands of millions. Later still, I had new worries. First of all, how to find jobs for the unemployed. Then, when unemployment had disappeared, where to find enough workers? We must install machines continually, new problems to settle. It's still the same today. We used to say, let's take prisoners. Now we think, what are we to do with all these prisoners? All refugees are alike. They fix their minds on a turning point in their own story, which they regard as a turning point in the history of the world. They ignore everything that may have happened since that moment, which for them is essential. Only a genius would be capable of transcending that private view of things. There are also psychological refugees. The Englishman is stranded on 9th of November, 1918, and thus Section 1.
Well, yeah. Wow. I'm sure you have quite a bit to say about that, so I'll wait on you.
Okay. Carolyn, I think in the very first sentence, the countries we invite to participate in our economic system should have their share in the natural riches of the Russian regions. And then he goes on to describe the rest of it. But participating in our economic system. Now, the National Socialist system, economic system, was based on barter and not on gold, because Germany had little to no gold. But it was a system that was in direct contradiction to the capitalist exploitive system, usury, and things like this. And I think the greatest fear of the haves back then, those nations that ganged up together to destroy Germany, was the fear that that National Socialist economic system would catch hold with nations and grow. And had it done that, had it been enabled to do that, and grown, then their exploitive economic system worldwide would have come to an end. And that's why I think that they crushed Germany beyond any sensible measure when that war was over, and they had to exterminate all evidence of the National Socialist system. And that's why this first intro here about economic affairs is so important, and it means so much. And
yeah, let me say something before I forget it.
Yeah, sure.
You know, what you said brought to my mind that the more brilliant and the more successful anything that those who are not a part of the capitalist system that you talked about is Well, it's like the better we do and the better people we have, the more dangerous it is for them, and the more they're going to fight against it, destroy it, and crush it. And Hitler had built one of the, and he had done it slowly and carefully, you know, adding territory that they had lost, gaining areas with industrial production and so on. And he had done all this so well, and he was stronger against this system than probably anything we've ever seen in modern times, and yet he was defeated. And it's not a positive picture that I'm drawing here. I mean, it's depressing. I think this kind of thing needs to be recognized when people are thinking about how we can make gains for nationalism and so on, because these powers that be have all kinds of means to go about this destruction. It's quite depressing.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, and another part of that particular section, when he's talking about the various worries he had, and he says, when unemployment had disappeared, where to find enough workers? You know, that this is going to be the next step. And it's ironic that the system that National Socialism brought to bear there in Germany got them out of that depression. Mm-hmm. And everybody knows how horrible the depression was in the United States, and how many millions of people suffered through that, and not many of them stopped to realize that the depression in Germany was worse than the one here. And the old story that all Americans are taught in their history books is that all Germany got out of that Great Depression by building the war machine and getting ready to conquer the world, when in actuality it was getting rid of those who controlled the German money supply and giving the control of the mark, or the German money supply, back to the German people. And when that happened, then the economy, which didn't have to rely on gold payments anymore but barter, B-A-R-T-E-R, took off, and it was astonishing the gains that were made in essence a very short time by the German economists.
Well, yeah, and you know, in reality, Adolf Hitler made Franklin Roosevelt look absolutely ineffective and sick and stupid.
That's exactly right.
They couldn't stand that, you know, so they had to make up this story about how it was and what a hero Roosevelt was. I grew up believing that because my father seemed to believe it. Well, he did believe it. I hate to admit that. He was a believer of that. And I was so convinced. I never would have doubted that that wasn't the case.
Well, there's no doubt in my mind that Roosevelt's hatred of Adolf Hitler and Germany, what it stood for, was out of envy.
Oh, yeah. Part of it was, yes. Part of it was. A big part of it, no doubt.
Right.
And let me remind the listeners that an autarkic economy is a self-sufficient economy.
Right.
And this was always the goal of Hitler and National Socialism.
Sure.
A lot of us today, we're taught that, well, you know, in the 90s when they started creating the globalist economy for real, and I remember, I was very aware of what was going on. And I remember trying to think, this is not good what's happening. But always there was this argument that I didn't know how to refute, that no, we were going to be so much better off, and everybody would be better off, but especially Americans were going to be so much better off when we had all these tariffs lifted or whatever, and we just traded with everyone, and it was going to help us, and it did just the opposite.
But
you know, that's when the message was, and people still believe it, that we have to be an interdependent world. We have to have, you know, depend on trade with one another and with everybody. And so that's where all these laws come from about why nationalism is so bad. But that was never the belief of that very successful Third Reich, that self-sufficiency is what you want.
Sure.
And then truthfully, then they invented, they had to have something like the Holocaust in order to then dismiss
discredit,
what
yeah.
discredit right what Hitler did.
Sure.
Saying, well, that kind of an economy and that kind of a thinking makes you just hate everybody else, and
right.
then that was the result of it. So, you know, it can all be put together in a very simple way, the truth of it.
Sure.
As we're doing right now.
Well, that's a very important point, you know, bringing in the thinking about the Holocaust. Well, any state that came up with that extermination program against the poor Jews, there nothing can be good can be said about it, and even their economic system, you know, has to be trashed as well. Now, this next section, short, also is very important economic-wise. Mm-hmm. Shall I go ahead with that?
Yeah, I just want to say it's too bad that we didn't hear a single word from Walter Funk. And there's another guest coming up, and we're not going to hear a word from him either. So I guess they didn't feel like they had anything
yeah,
to say enough to...
Hitler.
Maybe they just wanted to listen to Hitler, too.
Right, right.
Anyway, go ahead.
Okay, 13th of October, 1941, evening. I've been wondering lately whether it wouldn't be best to collect the men responsible for the control of the economics of the following countries, Denmark, Norway, Holland, Belgium, Sweden, and Finland. We'd give them a notion of the vistas that present themselves nowadays. The majority of them are not all aware of the immense field that opens up before us. And yet these are the men who have a positive interest in seeing to it that something should be done on behalf of their countries. If they clearly realize that an outlet can be found in Russia for their surplus population, and that their country can henceforward obtain all it requires, I think it not impossible that they may come over into our camp with banners waving. It would be a first step in a direction that would remind us of what the creation of the sovereign once meant to us. Today I laid my financial ideas before the Minister of Economic Affairs. He's enthusiastic. He foresees that in 10 years, Germany will have freed itself from the burden of the war without letting our purchasing power at home be shaken.
And he's mentioning Funk there, calling in
yes,
the Minister
yes.
of Economic Affairs.
Right off the bat, you know, when he's talking about the finance ministers of the various six countries that he mentioned, and he said, we'd give them a notion of the vistas that present themselves nowadays. Of course, that means National Socialism versus capitalism.
Well, and he was also, I took it that he was going to show them what was possible in Russia.
Yeah, right.
They had,
yeah. And he does mention that. And that
yeah.
Zollverein that he brought up and says, you know, it would be the first step in a direction that would remind us of what the creation of the Zollverein once meant to us. And I checked on that, Carolyn. It was you probably already knew this. It was a German customs union formed
yeah.
in 1834, and it was a coalition of German states that formed together to manage things like tariffs and economic policies, and it was a free trade area. Now, you take the average Joe in the USA today, and I'm talking about even white nationalists, whatever, and the phrase free trade, it shakes them up. You know, they say, no, this doesn't work and whatever. And that's because this concept of free trade that is being talked about right here in this book for Germany, those various countries were on the same level with a very, very similar standard of living, wages, production.
Right.
And when you have something like that among comparable nations, free trade is a very good way to go. But why free trade is killing the United States as far as manufacturing and economic viability is the fact that there is no such thing as equal standard of living. When you have free trade involving countries that are very, very different on the economic scale of either very low on it, very high on it, as a standard of living, as wages of production, things like this, and they're very different, the one at the top is going to suffer tremendously at the expense of the one on the bottom and the people, of course, running the system. Because you take a country like China, who pays wages of $2.50 a week, say, and Chrysler, let's say, goes over there, has their car produced, shipped back to the United States. Their cost of production goes way down, and they sell it for the same price or more here in the USA. Their profit margin goes way up, but who suffers is the working person that has to build that is building that machine here in the USA. He's cut out of a job. And that's why this free trade phoniness is indeed a bad thing for the United States.
Yes. That's very good, Ray. Thanks a lot for that. You know, I noticed that of these six countries that he mentioned, which are Northern European countries, Western European countries, four of them, the first four, were at war against Germany at the time, which they shouldn't have been. They're also related to Germany, but they had gone to war on the side of the British, but they were all occupied at that time by Germany. And then Sweden was neutral, and Finland was an ally in 1941. So that was the situation. But he was still making all these good plans for them to be all joined together. Okay, well, maybe I'll read.
Sure.
One here, 13th October at night, 1941. And let me get this up, move this up a little bit. He says, the other day I called off an attack that was to procure us a territorial gain of 4 kilometers because the practical benefit of the operation didn't seem to me to be worth the price it would have cost. I realize in this connection that it's more difficult to take a decision on a lower level than on the level of the high command. How could the man who carries out the orders and has no comprehensive view of the situation, how could he make up his mind with full knowledge of the pros and cons? Is he to demand a sacrifice from his men, or is he to spare them this sacrifice? All that was done in that respect during the First World War was sheer madness. The offensive at Verdun, for example, was an act of lunacy. From beginning to end, all the commanders responsible for that operation should have been put in straitjackets. We've not yet completely got over those mistaken notions. It's probable that throughout the 1914-1918 war, some 2,000 men were usually sacrificed by employing them as runners on missions that could have been equally well accomplished by night and with less danger. How often I myself have had to face a powerful artillery barrage in order to carry a simple postcard. It's true that later I had a commanding officer who completely put a stop to these practices. The spirit has changed since those days, and a day will come when such absurdities can no longer occur. A war commander must have imagination and foresight. So it's not extraordinary that our people is at once a people of soldiers and artists. My strength lies in the fact that I can imagine the situations that the troops are called upon to face, and I can do that because I've been an ordinary soldier myself. Thus one acquires the rapid understanding of the appropriate steps to take in every kind of circumstance. So
that speaks a lot, of course, to why the people, and particularly the military and the average Joe, the soldier, thought so much of Adolf Hitler, because he had been in the trenches and he knew what they an ordeal that they had in fighting any war, whatever. And he, of course, is talking here about the idiotic moves in World War One that cost so many lives, and they were wasted. Well, the lives were wasted, and I thought a comment here that really was strong was when he says, it's not extraordinary that our people is at once a people of soldiers and of artists. You know, talking about a war commander.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that what you meant? Because that's what he was.
Well, yeah. And having been an ordinary soldier myself, what he says there, then he can, one acquires a rapid understanding of the appropriate steps to take in every kind of circumstance.
And being an artist, he has the imagination.
Yes.
He's talking about a real artist. The artist temperament and so on goes deep. He has the imagination to picture different scenarios.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So let's go on.
All right. The night of 13th, 14th, October, 1941. And Adolf Hitler says, I've acquired the habit of avoiding every kind of vexation once evening has come. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to free myself from it all night. I likewise have the habit of allowing my dispatch rider to have a rest before I send him off. Some people are perhaps astonished not to get an answer to their letters. I dictate my mail, and then I spend a dozen hours without bothering about it. The next day, I make a first set of corrections, and perhaps a second set the day after. In doing so, I'm being very prudent. Nobody can use a letter in my own hand against me. Besides, it's my opinion that in an age when we have facilities like the train, the motor car, the aircraft, it's much better to meet than to write, at least when some matter of capital importance is at issue. You easily get your mind excited when you're writing to people. You want to show them your mettle. Your correspondent, of course, has that same wish. He answers you in the same tone, or else he rushes to see you in order to insult you. Not long ago, one of my colleagues came to ask my advice on how to answer an offensive letter. I simply forbade him to reply.
Let me cut in here and say, this is the problem we have on the Internet, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, everybody's familiar with this. So things are misunderstood, and you've never met people, and you've people who you feel you know very well, mm-hmm. but you've never met them in person.
Sure.
And
sure.
And yet you're doing all this stuff by writing. Sometimes now we have a lot of talking too, but we're not meeting in person. And he recognizes here how important that is. And,
that's right. So much can be lost without that face-to-face exchange.
Yes. And you know, when people write things, other people will take it differently because there's no inflection. There's no sense of meaning. You don't see expressions on their face or anything like that. And
exactly.
Boy, misunderstandings
are really
common.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And he goes on to say, we have a ridiculous law by which, in matters of insult, a complaint must be lodged immediately or else the right to bring suit lapses. It would be much more just to decide that complaints on such matters cannot be lodged until after a delay of 3 weeks. In fact, as a rule, the complainant's anger would have gone up in smoke, and the work of the courts would be lightened. I write drafts of letters only concerning matters of vital importance. It's what I did, for example, for the 4-year plan, and last year when I was contemplating the action against Russia. At present, I spend about 10 hours a day thinking about military matters. The resulting orders are a matter of half an hour or three-quarters of an hour. But first of all, every operation has to be studied and thought over at length. It sometimes takes up to 6 months for the thought to be elaborated and made precise. Doubtless the time will come when I shall no longer have to concern myself with the war or the Eastern Front, for it will be only a matter of carrying out what has been already foreseen and ordered. Thus, while these operations are being completed, I shall be able to devote my mind to other problems. What is fortunate for me is that I know how to relax. Before going to bed, I spend some time on architecture. I look at pictures. I take an interest in things entirely different from those that have been occupying my mind throughout the day. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to sleep. What would happen to me if I didn't have around me men whom I completely trust to do the work for which I can't find time? Hard men who act as energetically as I would do myself. For me, the best man is the man who removes the most from my shoulders, the man who can take 95% of the decisions in my place. Of course, there are always cases in which I have to take the final decision myself. I couldn't say whether my feeling that I'm indispensable has been strengthened during this war. One thing is certain, that without me, the decisions to which we today owe our existence would not have been taken.
Very good. I like that.
Yes.
There. Well, what I have here to say is that I just thought of this one thing just now. Giesler, when he says, before going to bed, I spend some time on architecture. Mm-hmm. And he likes to work on architecture with somebody else more than just by himself. I don't know how much time he spent by himself, but he liked having Herman. That's from 1941, it was, 45. Herman Giesler, he would summon, try to get Herman Giesler, who was very busy. He had all kinds of responsibilities on his shoulders, but they would try to get him there to just, you know, hang around and do what he could do. And sometimes during the daytime and always at night, he and Hitler would work on architecture together.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one of the things. And another thing I know what I thought of, he said that, he said, the best man for me is someone who can take 95% of the responsibility off my shoulders. And now that was Bormann. Bormann took over from Hess, and Hess was supposed to be doing that. I never heard exactly, you know, how that,
yes,
how he felt he did on that. But he knew that, but what Bormann was doing was, that was the whole thing, was that, and that's why Hitler kept supporting him, even though others complained about him. They wanted more access to Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, being indispensable, he in other cases talked about that. And he did believe that he was fulfilling a mission for Germany.
Sure.
And that he was the indispensable man. And so he tried to take care of himself and to, you know, carry on as best he could. He was not about to quit because he believed he was the indispensable man. And so did many, many around him. And then that decision, I figured that, what do you think, I'll ask you for whatever you want to say about it, plus what do you think that decision, which we today owe our existence, would not have been taken? I think that's one particular or several decisions, because he says decisions, plural.
Well, what I think he's doing right here, what I took from that, Carolyn, is when he talks about the kind of men he needs around him, and he definitely thinks he has those kind of men,
mm-hmm.
and they are very competent, but up to a point, and right there at that point is where he says this talk about, you know, whether me feeling that I'm indispensable has been strengthened because the decisions that had to have been made involving the war, and let's go to number one, Barbarossa. If he had been waiting around for other men who were quite competent in many areas to make that decision, that would not have been made. It wouldn't have been taken. It took him, because of his gift and his feeling that he's leading his nation and he has good men or whatever, but they have not advanced to that level where he could just turn. If he was gone, someone of equal ability could have stepped in and taken over.
That's right.
He was special, and I think he realized it and recognized it, that even the very best in the military affairs, in economic affairs, and things like this, as good as they were, because of their past limitations and restrictions upon them, they were hesitant to take that one powerful step that had to be done. And he jumps in, grabs a hold of the steering wheel, and says, "Let's put this thing in action and get going." And that's his uniqueness. That's what made him the leader that he was.
And there's people who used to say, and we used to not know for sure, but and a lot of people who still say, and the general consensus of people who don't know anything, is that, well, what a bad mistake that was to go into the Soviet Union. Oh, my God, if he hadn't have done that, he wouldn't have ended up with this gigantic war. But we know now from what has been revealed in, say, you know, I don't know when it started, but recent years, that if he hadn't done that, then Germany would have just been crushed by an attack by Stalin.
Yeah.
So they were eventually crushed anyway, but at least they had the chance to show a lot of heroism, and a lot of people were involved who weren't, I'm sure, are not sorry that they were involved in that, even though it suffered a lot of pain.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was good. Anything more?
Well, we're fixing to shift gears here.
Yes.
And we go from economics to religion and spirituality, which is, wow. I mean, this next particular section, 14th of October, midday is a little bit lengthy. But
yeah,
my
there's
goodness.
Two of them, I think, but I don't remember. There's one after this is also continues on with this.
Correct.
So we've got quite a bit. I think we can cover it in in this program. So let's try to do that.
Okay. And for this particular section here, this 14th of October, 1941, midday, note here, special guest, Reichsführer Himmler.
Right.
So,
Himmler's there. And we don't hear a word from him.
Right.
Or the note taker down the word. But he may have been quiet. Well, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, Carolyn, what I'm imagining here is that Himmler is listening to this discussion and actually probably has commented on it favorably or concurs with Hitler on a lot of what he has to say here regarding the church and state. It's just unfortunate that it was not, you know, responses or additional comments were not written down that Himmler made.
Right. And he may have been very quiet because everybody was kind of when Hitler started talking, everybody, including Himmler and Goering and anybody else, let him talk and didn't try to butt in or anything. So, but anyway, I just wanted to note that I looked on the timeline to see what Himmler was doing in October 1941, and the only thing was in July of that year, a few months earlier, he had been put in charge of security, race, and settlement tasks in Russia by Hitler. Otherwise, at this particular time, nothing special going on.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, for 14th October 1941, midday, special guest, Reichsführer Himmler. It may be asked whether concluding a concordat with the churches wouldn't facilitate our exercise of power. On this subject, one may make the following remarks. Firstly, in this way, the authority of the state would be vitiated by the fact of the intervention of a third power concerning which it is impossible to say how long it would remain reliable. In the case of the Anglican Church, this objection does not arise, for England knows she can depend on her church. But what about the Catholic Church? Wouldn't we be running the risk of her one day going into reverse after having put herself at the service of the state solely in order to safeguard her power? If one day the state's policy ceased to suit Rome or the clergy, the priests would turn against the state, as they are doing now. History provides examples that should make us careful. Secondly, there's also a question of principle. Trying to take a long view of things, is it conceivable that one could found anything durable on falsehood? When I think of our people's future, I must look further than immediate advantages, even if these advantages were to last 300, 500 years or more. I'm convinced that any pact with the church can only offer a provisional benefit, for sooner or later the scientific spirit will disclose the harmful character of such a compromise. Thus, the state will have based its existence on a foundation that one day will collapse. An educated man retains the sense of the mysteries of nature and bows before the unknowable. An uneducated man, on the other hand, runs the risk of going over to atheism, which is a return to the state of the animal, as soon as he perceives that the state, in sheer opportunism, is making use of false ideas in the matter of religion, whilst in other fields it bases everything on pure science. That's why I've always kept the party aloof from religious questions. I've thus prevented my Catholic and Protestant supporters from forming groups against one another and inadvertently knocking each other out with the Bible and the sprinkler. So we never became involved with these churches' forms of worship. And if that has momentarily made my task a little more difficult, at least I've never run the risk of carrying grist to my opponent's mill. The help we would have provisionally obtained from a concordat would have quickly become a burden on us. In any case, the main thing is to be clever in this matter and not look for a struggle where it can be avoided. Being weighed down by a superstitious past, men are afraid of things that can't or can't yet be explained. That is to say, of the unknown. If anyone has needs of a metaphysical nature, I can't satisfy them with the party's program. Time will go by until the moment when science can answer all the questions. So it's not opportune to hurl ourselves now into a struggle with the churches. The best thing is to let Christianity die a natural death. A slow death has something comforting about it. The dogma of Christianity gets worn away before the advances of science. Religion will have to make more and more concessions. Gradually, the myths crumble. All that's left is to prove that in nature, there is no frontier between the organic and the inorganic. When understanding of the universe has become widespread, when the majority of men know that the stars are not sources of light, but worlds, perhaps inhabited worlds like ours, then the Christian doctrine will be convicted of absurdity. Originally, religion was merely a prop for human communities. It was a means, not an end in itself. It's only gradually that became transformed in this direction, with the object of maintaining the rule of the priests, who can live only to the detriment of society collectively. The instructions of a hygienic nature that most religions gave contributed to the foundation of organized communities. The precepts ordering people to wash, to avoid certain drinks, to fast at appointed dates, to take exercise, to rise with the sun, to climb to the top of the minaret, all of these were obligations invented by intelligent people. The exhortation to fight courageously is also self-explanatory. Observe, by the way, that as a corollary, the Muslim was promised a paradise peopled with houris, where wine flowed in streams, a real earthly paradise. And he's talking about Islam there.
Right.
The Christians, on the other hand, declare themselves satisfied if after death they are allowed to sing hallelujahs. All of these elements contributed to form human communities. It is to these private customs that people owe their present characters. Christianity, of course, has reached the peak of absurdity in this respect, and that's why one day its structure will collapse. Science has already impregnated humanity. Consequently, the more Christianity clings to its dogmas, the quicker it will decline. But one must continue to pay attention to another aspect of the problem. It's possible to satisfy the needs of the inner life by an intimate communion with nature, or by knowledge of the past. Only a minority, however, at the present stage of the mind's development, can feel the respect inspired by the unknown, and thus satisfy the metaphysical needs of the soul. The average human being has the same needs, but can satisfy them only by elementary means. That's particularly true of women, as also of peasants who impotently watch the destruction of their crops. The person whose life tends to simplification is thirsty for belief, and he dimly clings to it with all of his strength. Nobody has the right to deprive simple people of their childish certainties until they've acquired others that are more reasonable. Indeed, it's important that the higher belief should be well established in them before the lower belief has been removed. We must finally achieve this, but it would serve no purpose to replace an old belief by a new one that would merely fill the place left vacant by its predecessor. It seems to me that nothing would be more foolish than to reestablish the worship of Wotan. Our old mythology had ceased to be viable when Christianity implanted itself. Nothing dies unless it's moribund. At that period, the ancient world was divided between the systems of philosophy and the worship of idols. It's not desirable that the whole of humanity should be stultified, and the only way of getting rid of Christianity is to allow it to die little by little. A movement like ours mustn't let itself be drawn into metaphysical digressions. It must stick to the spirit of exact science. It's not the party's function to be a counterfeit for religion. If, in the course of 1,000 or 2,000 years, science arrives at the necessity of renewing its point of view, that won't mean that science is a liar. Science cannot lie, for it's always striving, according to the momentary state of knowledge, to deduce what is true. When it makes a mistake, it does so in good faith. It's Christianity that is the liar. It is in perpetual conflict with itself. One may ask whether the disappearance of Christianity would entail the disappearance of a belief in God. That is not to be desired. The notion of divinity gives most men the opportunity to concretize the feeling they have of supernatural realities. Why should we destroy this wonderful power they have of incarnating the feeling for the divine that is within them? The man who lives in communion with nature necessarily finds himself in opposition to the churches, and that's why they're heading for ruin, for science is bound to win. I especially wouldn't want our movement to acquire a religious character and institute a form of worship. It would be appalling for me, and I would wish I'd never lived if I were to end up in the skin of a Buddha. If at this moment we were to eliminate the religions by force, the people would unanimously beseech us for a new form of worship. You can imagine our Gauliters giving up their pranks to play at being saints. As for our minister for religion, according to his own co-religionists, God himself would turn away from his family. I envisage the future, therefore, as follows. First of all, to each man his private creed. Superstition shall not lose its rights. The party is sheltered from the danger of competing with the religions. These latter must simply be forbidden from interfering in future with temporal matters. From the tenderest age, education will be imparted in such a way that each child will know all that is important to the maintenance of the state. As for the men close to me, who, like me, have escaped from the clutches of dogma, I've no reason to fear that the church will get its hooks on them. We'll see to it that the churches cannot spread abroad teachings in conflict with the interests of the state. We shall continue to preach the doctrine of National Socialism, and the young will no longer be taught anything but the truth.
Wow.
Wow, indeed.
Oh, that is the end of it. I thought it was in two different nights, but now we go into meteorological forecast. Okay, so we can talk about this at length. We have 10 minutes. I have lots of comments on this.
Good, good.
I imagine you do, too. I'm not going to go all the way back to the beginning to start. Here's what it was. He said he wouldn't want the movement to acquire a religious character. You know, I talk sometimes about the people who want to turn Hitler into a divinity.
Yes.
And to think that we really do seriously think that, well, we need a religion. We don't like Christianity, so we should make a religion around Hitler. But some of these people who had that idea have given that up because now they've got some other ideas they can use. So it's not too much right on my plate. But he says it would be appalling for him if he would end up in the skin of a Buddha, meaning as some kind of religious divinity.
Exactly.
That they were showing him to be. And what's the woman's name? I can't think. The Indian who lived in India that you like so much.
Oh.
She was kind of
yes.
doing that, you know.
Yes.
She thought that was a
Savitri
good
idea.
Savitri Devi.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and I never did quite take to that, but now I'm even more opposed to it since I know that Hitler wouldn't like that at all. And, you know, another thing about this whole section, Ray, is that a lot of people, because he says a lot of things here. Now, again, the translation probably could have been done differently. And this translation may be done in such a way as to make him as anti-Christian as possible. But I don't think you can deny, I think this is his feelings, and I don't think it can be denied that he was not a practicing Christian ever since he was a child. And he was not, his thoughts were generally against the church. And, you know, he starts with the concordant, and there was a concordant with the churches. There was one with the Catholic Church, and maybe there was called something else with the Protestant Church, but I think it must have fallen apart by this time. Mm-hmm. And the war made a big difference.
True.
In his relationship with the churches, and then they started complaining about different things. I mean, I've covered some of that. Won't go into that now, but it because he's talking like there is no concordance, and he wouldn't want there to be one.
Right.
But at one time he did want it. That was though in the right when he became chancellor in the 33 to 36 or so, and he had a lot of people working on that, Protestants, really, because the German Christian Church and so on. And people still talk about that and say that's what he was for. And I wouldn't argue with it because, you know, he would never say these things he says here in private, in public. Now, we got to remember, this is a private conversation.
Correct.
And it's being recorded with the idea that it would be available to the party members or, you know, to the faithful in the future to have these words of wisdom. Mm-hmm. From Hitler, like after he's gone and so on.
Sure.
It wasn't going to be published. So he wasn't trying to stir up anything. And he presented himself as comfortable with the churches in Germany. He was like an evolutionary. He talks about how the world people will slowly learn better and become more intelligent, and he saw that happening in an evolutionary way. Mm-hmm. And you couldn't rush it; they'd learn
sure.
more and more. And actually, he thought people would become smarter and more intelligent, particularly under his National Socialist system, which encouraged all people. And he even says right at the ending, "We're not only going to teach our children the truth." So. Eventually, he saw the race being lifted up higher mm-hmm. above what he called the dogma of religion, whatever religion it was.
Right, right.
Okay.
And that was to happen by natural progression, as you said, step by step, mm-hmm. Not jumping from A to the letter Z. You go A, B, C, and you go all the way through, and by natural progression. Now, at the start of this particular unit, he mentions quite correctly about England and its Anglican church. You don't have this problem. He said England knows that she can depend on her church. But what about the Catholic Church? Now, it takes a guy who has studied and realized the history of the Catholic Church and its function from way back and to realize that it was and is a power entity to be reckoned with. And you say in the 14th, 15th century, what was the most powerful institution existing? It was the church. It wasn't monarchy, some military dictatorship. It was the church. And Hitler knew that that particular church put its foot down on trying to keep the masses as ignorant and servile as possible. And they did that by assuring the have-nots of their place in life, that their reward was going to come after death, and to accept the lot that they had in life. And as well as when the press was invented, the printing press was invented, that really set the church back, because the last thing they wanted was a literate populace. Hitler knew all of those things, and he knew that like he says, I thought was an excellent observation by Hitler when he said, wouldn't we be running the risk of her one day, meaning the Catholic Church, one day going into reverse after having put herself at the service of the state solely in order to safeguard her power? So he saw the power in that institution of the Catholic Church and saw that it could be a very detrimental threat. And when he goes on and says, I'm convinced that any pact with the church can only offer provisional benefit, and, for sooner or later the scientific spirit will disclose the harmful character of such a compromise, and thus the state will have based its existence on a foundation that one day will collapse. I think what he's talking about here, Carolyn, is basing your existence on something regarding faith and emotionalism versus reason and logic, and that particular clash. If you start mixing those, you're going to run the risk of harming your entire movement and nation. So I know we want to hear some of that wonderful music. So
yeah, but that's very good. That's very, very good, Ray. And boy, there's a lot. I encourage people to go and find this long passage if you're interested in it and speak about it.
Mm-hmm.
But so I'm going to say goodnight for us both right now, and we'll be right back next week, ladies and gentlemen. So join us again next Thursday. Good night.
Good night, all.